It's been a busy few weeks, okay, months for Unitarian Universalists. Like I said before, it's like wake up, read the paper, find the protest, repeat, repeat. Over the past few weeks, my colleagues in the D.C. area have been part of an interfaith coalition protesting at the U.S. Senate, responding to the threat to healthcare coverage, especially for the most vulnerable among us. Our Unitarian Universalist Association president, meanwhile, issued midweek this past week a public statement in response to the president's tweet about trans folks serving in the military, calling it blatant discrimination. And our longstanding commitment to lifespan sex education by way of our OWL programs have led many of us to help to be helpful translators for our non-UU friends encountering the language that my kids would call inappropriate coming out of the White House the past few days, right? Now, looking beyond just the past few weeks, over the past few years, Unitarian Universalist congregations have been boldly declaring themselves sanctuary congregations, hanging Black Lives Matter signs, and lobbying on behalf of science education, climate justice, and environmental sustainability. Going back even further, for example, in 1965, we were proud to send many of our clergy and lay leaders to Selma, including the Reverend Walter Royal Jones, who was the minister of this congregation, to join with Martin Luther King Jr. in his March for Civil Rights. In our own congregation, we have been faithfully serving those who are impacted by poverty and homelessness, rallying for improved access to health care and reproductive rights, companioning our immigrant neighbors in their fight for justice, holding vigils with the interfaith community in reaction to violence against Muslim and GLBT people. And every Sunday, we share half of our offering, or like this Sunday, our whole offering, with our community partners so that we can have an even greater reach of justice in Northern Colorado and beyond. All this is to say, there is no doubt that we Unitarian Universalists understand social justice as a key part of our religious practice. As we say in our covenant, service is our law. And like we've been singing the past few Sundays with the song, Spirit of Life, we long to give life the shape of justice. In fact, sometimes we're clearer on the justice part of our religious practice than we are on the religious part of our religious practice. Though we hope it would not be the case today, at some points in our history, we must confess the 80s and 90s were particularly susceptible. A guest might wander into a Unitarian Universalist church and get it confused with the local meeting for progressive grassroots activists, or even when we've really lost our way, the local chapter of the Democratic Party. Like I said, we hope this isn't the case here and now, but it is something that we do need to remain mindful of, that we always ask ourselves, what differentiates the work that we're doing here for justice from any other work we might do with any other organization? What makes our commitment to justice a religious commitment? Or to put it in an even broader frame, what is the theology that grounds and shapes and energizes our Unitarian Universalist commitment to social justice? Now, theology at its root means an attempt to speak about God. But for our conversation today, I want to translate this attempt into three simple questions: why, what, and how. As in, why are we Unitarian Universalists committed to social justice? Why do we even care? And what do we mean by justice? Who does it involve? And how do we believe that justice is achieved? See, three simple questions. I came to some crisis about our theology of social justice in seminary as I became more and more familiar with what's known as liberation theology. Liberation theology has this conviction that God has a preferential option for the poor, by which they mean that God's love is universal and requires then an equalizing of all people so that the powerless are brought into equal vision and rank as the powerful. an equalizing, which, given all the forces of our world, would require, the forces of our world that move in the opposite direction, would require a preference, the preferential option for the poor, the disempowered, the vulnerable. Now, coming from a Catholic family that was heavy on Catholic social teaching, this clear assertion of an imperative to care for and even more equalize the vulnerable and disempowered spoke to me. But my crisis came when I wondered, is there anything like that sort of imperative in Unitarian Universalism? Or is it instead more, to use the technical term, wishy-washy? This is the sort of crisis of faith that Unitarian ethicist James Luther Adams felt quite urgently in the early 20th century as he confronted Nazism while studying in Germany. He wondered, with all seriousness, if fascism should arise in the United States, what in liberal religion's past performance would constitute a pattern or framework for resistance? Sadly, he could think of no sure or satisfying answer. Nothing that he would describe as liberal religion's costing commitment. Now, last week, I spoke in the Chalice Lighting about Unitarian Universalism as a faith oriented to our shared commitments. What I called then, I said, was our shared commitment to the well-being of all. Now, I'm going to come back to that in just a moment, but this phrase, costing commitment, in saying, using that phrase, Adams was pushing this idea of what binds us together even further, because he wanted to know, in what ways would these binding commitments, these shared commitments, translate into a shared conviction and shared sacrifice that it would take to sufficiently respond and resist such a thing as the Holocaust? What is, he wondered, the underlying theology of liberal religion? Remember, the why, the what, the how. What is it that would compel us and keep us clear and committed, even when the journey becomes painful, when much is at risk, and when all feels lost? These are not irrelevant questions for today. Now, to answer them, I actually do need to go back to last Sunday's service when Robert was exploring the first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. This principle is often the thing that brings people in to Unitarian Universalism, our affirmation that all have worth, no matter what. But it's also the thing that can trip people up the most as they try to live it out. Like I saw on my Facebook feed after the service last Sunday, there was a discussion going on with that common question. So, when we say everyone, does that include dot, dot, dot? Just pick your, whoever the person is that you find most reprehensible. I mean, even if you interpret affirming someone's worth as about respect instead of love, as Robert encouraged, the inherent worth of everyone, everyone, is not easy to apply. At least it isn't if we're assuming that human worth is about humans. That would be the Unitarian approach to our first principle, and I do mean Unitarian rather than Unitarian Universalist. Now, since we are doing the basics of Unitarian Universalism, let me pause here just to clarify. Unitarian Universalism is the product of the 1961 consolidation of two historical faith traditions, aka heretical faith traditions. Unitarianism, the first, the affirmation of the unity of God, which was really originally just simply the rejection of the Trinity. Unitarianism, it was a slang originally, pejorative slang. It also was the affirmation of the inherent goodness of humanity, which was a rejection to Calvinism's doctrine of predestination and total depravity. So you can see it's this Unitarian tradition that often grounds the way that people look at our first principle. And I know it can be very life-giving to look for the goodness of humanity as a way of assessing their worth, to look for it intentionally, to find that divine spark within each person, to see it visibly. And you can often see plenty of evidence revealing our overwhelming kindness, beauty, generosity. But if you keep looking, you can also just as easily start to wonder if Calvin was right and humans are no better than worms. Which is why we can be grateful that in addition to Unitarianism, we are also inheritors of the Universalist tradition, which is that heresy that a loving God would not send any of God's people to hell, a commitment that eventually declared that there just wasn't hell at all, period, that ultimately we are all reconciled in God's love. Now, there's a story you might know that summarizes the good news of Universalism about the 19th century Universalist and itinerant preacher Hosea Ballou. Ballou was in one of his usual debates about Universalism when one of his friends asked him, or said to him, "Brother Ballou, if I were a Universalist and feared not the fires of hell, I could hit you over the head, steal your horse and your saddle, and ride away, and I'd still go to heaven." Hosea Ballou looked over at him and said, "If you were a Universalist, the idea would never occur to you." Now, to be honest, when I first heard this story, I thought the Ballou sounded kind of like a pompous jerk. Because it was like he was saying that Universalists were so good that they'd never even think of doing all that bad stuff that his friend described. But actually, and you probably figured this out before I did, but that's not what Ballou was saying. What he's actually getting at is that revolutionary idea that is the core of Universalism. That there is no way to earn your worthiness, which means there's also no way to lose it. That no matter what you do or who you are never beyond the reach of love. You are always worthy of love, always worthy of healing and wholeness. It's a given, inherent, no matter what. Which, not given by a human person, of course, which also means it can't be taken away by a human person, you or me or anyone. It's simply true by way of your life. The first principle is written in terms describing every person, but from this perspective, it isn't really a statement about people. It's a statement about life itself, the very spirit of life, the nature of life, what some would call God. Thomas Starr King, both a 19th century Unitarian and Universalist, so the perhaps very first Unitarian Universalist, described these two different approaches, the Unitarian and the Universalist approach, to human worth this way. Universalists believe that God is too good to damn people, and Unitarians believe that people are too good to be damned. It's too fine a point, actually, to make about our two traditions, but I appreciate the way that he's lifting up that there are two different sorts of commitments implied by our first principle, the one affirming human goodness, the other affirming the goodness of God. Pairing the two together makes space for the common difficulty that people have with the first principle, because the inherent worth need not have that much to do with human behavior or even the human heart. Instead, it can be an affirmation of a perpetual and insistent grace that holds us all. An affirmation of God as all-embracing love. Or as the reading puts it, an affirmation of love beyond God. That is, love beyond our understanding. Love beyond language. But still somehow something we've experienced. Something we know. Felt in our hearts, a love that connects us somehow to everything and all, past, present, and future. Now, in his message, Robert asserted that all of our principles and all of our faith boils down to the first one, the inherent worth and dignity. It's likely what I would think is his answer to that big why of our justice work. But for me, if I had to pick just one and call it the core of our faith, I'd turn to the seventh, which is the interdependent web of all existence, of which we are just a part. which I think is another way of affirming that connective force that holds us all. From this perspective, stealing your horse and your saddle couldn't possibly hurt you and leave me untouched, because we are wrapped up together. We all go together. As Martin Luther King Jr. described, we are caught up in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny, a love that holds us and connects us and will not let us go no matter what. This connecting love is the why of our work for justice. But it also tells us the what and the who, and even points us towards the how. Because it is when we know ourselves, even more when we feel ourselves, when we experience ourselves as held in this love, that we are compelled to act for the well-being of all. To act, as Adrienne Marie Brown puts it, in right relationship with the whole planet. What we would call for shorthand, to act for social justice. Because we know we belong to each other. Now, in this great web of all, we are a part of everything, and everything is a part of us. We're dependent on everything, and that also means everything is dependent on us. We are actors in this system, co-creators, so that everything we do is a part of making justice possible and has an effect on the whole. But still, there can be no such thing in this view as a solo actor. No one can make things right by themselves, nor move us towards wholeness in isolation. There is no isolation. A commitment to human flourishing requires, then, relationship. Like ethicist Sharon Welch says, there is no morality possible outside relationship. Justice comes only through collaboration, adaptability, creativity, and our active, intentional partnership with one another, and that force of love beyond. Which isn't at all wishy-washy. But still, I want to push us a little further, remembering James Luther Adams' question about the costing commitment, which I kind of translate into, what is the skin? What is our skin in the game? Like, what's at risk for us in this work? Because we could recite our theology and commitment to social justice every week. We could all memorize it. We could say, and we do, that service is our law. And we could be very clear about our words and our heads about why we care and what it's about and how it works. But if that's where it stays on our lips and in our heads, then we could still return back to our lives. And as Martin Luther King also said, sleep through the revolution. Which is why I want to add just one more element to our theology of social justice. It goes back to that poem that Grace read from Adam Dyer, and that imaginative urging that he offers about our interconnectedness. That somehow, when my heart breaks, your tears fall. That somehow my tender touch comforts you. I love imagining that. But I've come to realize that imagination only takes us so far. Because it's hard to feel the love that connects us all in theory. A real theology of social justice requires that we move out of that theory, like Diane was saying, and out of the words, which, by the way, is the same conclusion that those liberation theologians come to. If we are to truly overcome what Robert called the death-dealing forces of today's world, we've got to move into that real work of relationship building, especially across difference. To use our own privilege to take risks on behalf of others, and to allow our hearts to be broken, and when we're lucky, broken open. To more love, to more possibility, and to that grace that connects us all. Knowing and trusting that we are a part of this great love that is beyond everything, so that we can only possibly choose to pass it on. May it be so, and amen.